So despite killings in the past and concerns about police brutality, nothing really captured the nation's attention quite like the Michael Brown killing by Darren Wilson. Why do you think what happened in Ferguson was such a tipping point nationally?
First, just the sheer act of leaving his body in the street for 4.5 hours, the level of disrespect was just untenable. And then secondly, that there was a rage and a level of discontent that was boiling under the surface in Ferguson. There are 21,000 people in Ferguson, 15,000 African Americans, 10,000 of them had arrest warrants in 2014. In 2013, over 23,000 tickets and arrest warrants issued, given the fact that the Ferguson's budget, about 1/4 of his budget, was coming from tickets. And so minor, quote unquote, offenses were leading people to jail and have to deal with enormous amounts of debt as it relates to the municipal government ticketing process. And so when you add that up and then the constant harassment of young folks by the police in Ferguson, it boiled over once they left his body in the street for 4.5 hours.
So really, because that stuff didn't come out till later, it was probably more the body in the street that really caught the nation's and world's attention?
Yes. In addition to leaving his body in the street, then they were going to put his body in the trunk of a car and then the SUV, which was not much more dignified, was the response to the community saying that if you put his body in the trunk of a car, there's going to be a problem. Then they allowed dogs to urinate on the makeshift memorial that was fertilized with his blood, that was planted in his blood. And then the hyper-militarized response of the police to young folks engaging in their democratic rights that are protected under the First Amendment. And so you add all of that up, it became an unfortunate perfect storm that led to the fact that you and I are having this conversation over a year later.
Well, you've been heavily involved in the ongoing protests in Ferguson, not just, you know, in the week or two afterwards. And your role in those protests, and I would imagine other protests around the country, was and continues to be as clergy. Why do you feel the need to be, quote, clergy during the protests and demonstrations as opposed to just being, you know, a regular schmo?
Well, I am a regular schmo who happens to be a clergy person.
Right.
In that, the reality is that the tradition that I come out of, the way in which I understand Jesus, in terms of the context of Christian orthodoxy, right, that God became flesh. And so that God chose to become flesh in the body of an unwed teenage mother among an unimportant people in an unimportant part of the world living under occupation. And that Jesus was subject to the arbitrary policing of the Roman Empire and was executed by the state. And according to the Christian mythos, he defeated the empire by way of resurrection. And so how I understand Jesus as a nonviolent revolutionary resisting occupation, it stands to reason that Jesus calls us to be in the street. And that in the streets of Ferguson, I was born again, and that I met God for myself, and that God is angry, and that God is queer, and God is a woman. God has tattoos on God's face. And so for me, it is a logical extension of a certain kind of theology of which I subscribe to.
To your comment about Jesus resisting occupation, you've often compared the situation in Ferguson, and I would guess by extension, you know, other places in America, Chicago, Oakland, Baltimore, you've compared these places with Palestine, both currently and Palestine of the time of Jesus. Why do you see it that way?
Well, so when you look at the material conditions, right, first century at Palestine is an occupied territory whereby first century Palestinian Jews are subject to arbitrary the violence of the state. Subject to high levels of taxing, subject experiencing high forms of hunger, malnutrition, and dislocation. And so those three features, when you look at the numbers of hunger and poverty in America, when you look at the way in which police function as occupying forces in black communities, those for me are direct links and make that comparison. And then in the contemporary moment, having spent time in Palestine in 2012, the material conditions that the Palestinians live under in Israeli occupation, particularly in the West Bank, looked very similar, combined with the police chiefs in many of the police chiefs in the greater St. Louis region were trained in Israel or trained by Israeli forces. And many of the tactics that were used on us in the streets of Ferguson are the same military tactics that I saw in Israel being used, particularly in the community Nabi Sela. And then lastly, in terms of a material point, that the same company that makes the tear gas that was shot at us in Ferguson makes the tear gas that was shot at us when I was in Palestine. And in the case of Von Derrick Myers, we're upon the one-year anniversary of his killing by a off-duty police officer working for a company that is a part of the parent company that has ties to the organization that runs the prisons in Palestine. And so both kind of theologically at a material level, we see that these things are both a part and parcel of a reality that young black folks are experiencing in America and that young Palestinians are experiencing under Israeli occupation.
At one point, I don't know if you still feel this way, but at one point you said that clergy, including yourself, had betrayed black youth. And I think that was a time
yes.
around Ferguson. What did you mean that you had and other clergy had betrayed black youth?
I mean, when you look at the way in which, one, that the predominance of a kind of prosperity theology that is at work in America, two, the nature of the way in which black folks find themselves trying to make some sense of the world, and that one of the roles that the black church has always played is the constitution of a black self. Black self-dignity and black respectability, and that the predominance of respectability politics, i.e. pull your pants up, dress well, the system won't bother you, and combined with a clergy have often sided with and been in negotiating with police agencies. And so in that sense, we have betrayed them because the black freedom struggle has always placed a premium on black people, on black youth. And then my experience in the context of the black church in the rural South and then secondarily here in the St. Louis area has been one in which I was celebrated, loved, and cared for. And so that, for many young people, is not their experience.
You're very involved in the Black Lives Matter movement. It's a movement that came out of the Trayvon Martin killing and really picked up steam with, you know, the killings of Michael Brown and Eric Garner and maybe John Crawford. The movement is getting pushback from especially white conservatives, but it's also getting bewilderment from some especially white liberals who thought maybe they understood and identified. What is the message of Black Lives Matter? And in your opinion, why are so many people on both sides of the aisle having such a difficult time digesting the message?
Well, I think that part of it is that in terms of Black Lives Matters as the organization, and I want to make a distinction between Black Lives Matters, the organization, and the movement for Black Lives. Okay. Black Lives Matters, the organization, is led by two queer black women and their comrade. It articulates a vision of the world that makes a centrality of black humanity. We live in a moment whereby the articulation of the obvious is revolutionary. So saying that Black Life Matters, right, it disrupts the discourse, right? Just saying it, because people respond not by saying, yes, Black Life Matters and other matters matter too. They respond by saying all lives matter. So it's to erase black suffering and black misery and to subjugate it to a kind of false post-racial discourse. And then the other piece, I think, has to do with that it has jettisoned respectability politics. So it's just not simply about negotiating with the powers. It's just not simply about preachers and cufflinks and suits marching, but it's about being led by queer young black women. It's been led by folks who are, many of them are quote unquote unchurched and have a deep distrust, if not disdain, for the church. So it represents a new moment. And so it's unsettling to a lot of people because we have a reified and conservative notion of what the civil rights movement looked like, and particularly what the role of Martin Luther King was and his relationship to the powers.
Well, and that was my observation too, is that it does feel different from what I identify as the civil rights movement, say from the 50s and 60s, and that the people today seem to be not embracing mainstream institutions. And is that pretty much what you're saying?
Yes, that most of them have either been rejected because they are queer, called into question various forms of fundamentalism, and don't find it as a space that appeals to both their humanity and their spiritual need.
So do you think it's going to work?
Dear brother, that's for the historians in heaven to answer. All I know is that they will continue to kill us and the people will continue to resist.
When Ferguson happened, and it was all over the television screens all over the world, what I noticed about the coverage itself, it seemed to be focused on the violence itself. That was always the lead, whether it was television or radio. It was like, well, there was very little violence in Ferguson last night. It was like the first sentence out. It's like they were fixated on the violence itself and not on what was going on. It's almost like people couldn't understand where that anger, where that comes from. Can you address that a little bit?
Well, I would just simply respond by saying, if you're not pissed off, you're not paying attention.
Well, you mentioned Democratic Socialist, a self-proclaimed Democratic Socialist is Bernie Sanders. He's running for president. And he got into a little bit of a thing at the Netroots Nation with the Black Lives Matter movement. And he's always been talking about the high unemployment rate of blacks, the high incarceration rate of blacks, and how this is a huge problem. But it seems to be that Black Lives Matter is saying yes, but it's more than that.
I want to pull back and look at it broader. Right now, what we have, if the progressive movement in this kind of particular age of Ferguson, that the best that they can produce is a 70-year-old white brother who's done some pretty progressive things in his life, it speaks to the level of paucity and vacuousness that is at work in our America, in our political life. That we have a string of mediocre candidates, recycled insiders who are more and more right-wing and centrist in their politics. And while Bernie Sanders has good politics on the domestic front, his silence on the American imperial project and the empire in terms of his military bases, his silence on the question of Israeli occupation, which is the most burning issue in the Middle East, reveals to us that there's just a level of mediocrity and that we are faced with an anemic liberalism and a cowardly mainstream political discourse.
Okay. Well, you're committed to nonviolent protests, as was Dr. King, and referring to the title of your talk here at Illinois State University, how is the future of nonviolent protest either different or going to be different than what nonviolent protest was in the past?
So part of it has to do with just the historical context, right? That the vast majority of Martin Luther King marches depended upon state intervention, right? Depended on laws, depended on protections. We see the rescinding of those protections when local police officers come and attack protesters, both Birmingham and Selma in particular. That King begins to articulate a militant nonviolence in his last book, Trumpet of Conscience, which came out a few months after his assassination. And he begins to articulate a militant nonviolent civil disobedience that it was preoccupied with a direct confrontation with the state to prick the conscience of the nation in order to create some form of public policy and public discourse, in order to deal with the various forms of state violence that we were encountering in the 1960s. And so this idea of kind of mandated these kind of quietude marches, these kind of somber marches, whereas that a lot of young folks are more raucous, that the musical undergirding of this era of protest is not the black church, it is hip hop. And so hip hop has a different tendency around boisterousness, around polyrhythms that are also connected to black musical forms, but also articulate a different level of rage and anxiety at work in public space. And so for me, militant nonviolent civil disobedience is a capturing of the best of King's militant nonviolent tradition and applying it to this particular moment.
Okay. Final question. When you were called, when you got the call to minister, is what you're doing now part of that calling initially? Did you hear that or did that come later?
Oh, well, I came out of a tradition of black folks who loved deeply, who believed deeply in the life of the mind and in justice. And so when I go back to Arkansas, where I was raised until I was 15 before moving to St. Louis, I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing, and it is their expectation of me.
Well, Asajj Fu-Sekou, thank you so much for your time and sharing your thoughts. We're looking forward to seeing you on campus here in a couple of days.
Bless you, dear brother. Be well.